Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. This week, we've got five cases and not a single win for non-citizens. We discuss some harsh law from the BIA, the material support of terrorism bar, and some text-based statutory interpretation. Have I piqued your interest yet? We're going to go in chronological circuit order, starting with the BIA and ending with the Ninth Circuit. And even though we've got five losses, there are always nuggets and observations to be had. I've done my best. Before we begin, heads up to Seventh Circuit practitioners, and not discussed on the show today, the Seventh Circuit slightly amended its June 26th decision in Meza Morales v. Barr, an important case about administrative closure, matter of Castro-Tum, U visas, and INA Section 212D3A waivers. The original case was discussed on the podcast on June 29th, so check it out. And now, on to the first case. First up this week is matter of RCR, published by the BIA. This is a pretty harsh one from the BIA, but the holding alone, without the facts or the dicta, is pretty unremarkable. Quote, after an immigration judge has set a firm deadline for filing an application for relief, the respondent's opportunity to file the application may be deemed waived prior to a scheduled hearing. If the deadline passes without submission of the application and no good cause for noncompliance has been shown. End quote. Here's how the BIA got there. The non-citizen in this case was detained in an immigration prison located in rural Louisiana and didn't have an attorney. At his first hearing, the non-citizen, who didn't speak English, stated through an interpreter that he wanted to apply for asylum. The judge, appearing over the video from New York, ordered that the non-citizen needed to file his asylum application in English, along with all supporting documentation in English, within 1 month, and that the final hearing would occur in 2.5 months. Just an aside, and as many of you know, asylum applications and packets are incredibly complicated, and there are severe repercussions for filling them out incorrectly. It can be suicide for a case to do so without an attorney. This non-citizen did not have an attorney, detained in rural Louisiana as he was, and he missed his filing deadline. A week later, and over a month before the final hearing, the judge decided that the non-citizen had abandoned his asylum application because he missed his deadline, and he ordered the non-citizen removed to Guatemala. After finally obtaining an attorney, the non-citizen appealed to the BIA. The BIA held that the IJ acted properly, and that the facts that I just stated about the case complied with constitutional due process. The BIA held that if this detained non-citizen, who didn't speak English and didn't have an attorney, needed more time to file his application, quote, he could have filed a motion requesting that the immigration judge extend the deadline for submitting his application, end quote. Or, this non-citizen without an attorney could have filed a motion to reconsider or a motion to reopen following the denial of his case. But he did none of those things, and so he lost his case. The BIA also held that there is nothing constitutionally problematic about video hearings in immigration court. And that's the case. Here are three practice pointers and observations. First, for what it's worth, the BIA did affirm that notwithstanding the Attorney General's 700 case completion requirement placed on immigration judges in 2017, the good cause standard still applies to any request for a continuance. And according to the BIA, this standard also applies to motions to reconsider and motions to reopen, or even motions to remand filed with the BIA. That's pretty good. And had good cause been shown in this case, quote, reconsideration or reopening by the immigration judge would likely have been appropriate, end quote. All right, so attorneys, explain your good cause in every motion and distinguish your case from the Attorney General's decision in 2018, matter of LABR. Not such a difficult task, because the facts deemed lacking good cause in that case were pretty egregious. Similarly, if you miss your deadline or if you come into a similar situation as this case on appeal, make sure you attach your client's untimely application to your motion or appeal. The BIA notes numerous times that the non-citizen never submitted an application and expressly states that if he had, the outcome may have been different. So as soon as possible after a missed deadline, file something or a motion with the untimely application attached and make robust good cause arguments. And finally, please allow me to get onto a stump about forum shopping. Government attorneys and individuals across the political spectrum often complain about forum shopping, that is, litigants who intentionally bring lawsuits in specific circuits. Conservative senators, for example, often complain that entities like the ACLU tend to bring their lawsuits more frequently in district courts located in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, in the hope of receiving a judge more sympathetic to their case. That's not the only reason litigants decide where to file, but it's of course a factor. It's important to recognize, however, that conservative entities consider the same factor. It's no accident that the Republican-controlled states challenged the Obama administration's DAPA program in the Southern District of Texas, which itself is located in the more conservative-leaning U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. And this very case from the BIA demonstrates that ICE is also kind of forum shopping, based on where it detains non-citizens. It's common knowledge that a disproportionate amount of immigration prisons are located in rural portions of Louisiana, Texas, and Mississippi. Non-citizens are transferred to those prisons from all over the country. And as footnote 1 in this case makes clear, the immigration courts must apply the law of the circuit where the immigration prison is located, not where the judge is located. And so, because the non-citizen in this case was detained in rural Louisiana, Fifth Circuit law applied, and this decision will be appealed to the Fifth Circuit, despite the fact that the judge was sitting in New York, based in the Second Circuit. This is important for many reasons, not least of which because the Fifth Circuit has issued decisions that appear to support the BIA's holding on the constitutionality of video hearings, while other circuits, such as the Fourth, Seventh, and Ninth Circuits, have issued decisions that may undermine it. I doubt it was an accident that the BIA chose to publish this case in this circuit for that holding. So the BIA, too, appears to be playing the forum shopping game. And that is matter of RCR. Next is a case out of the Third Circuit, published on September 2nd, 2020, AA v. Attorney General of the U.S. This is a case about asylum and the material support of terrorism, a matter so serious that the Third Circuit has referred to the non-citizen simply by his initials. I also feel compelled to note that the case includes a Marbury v. Madison citation, and it's a doozy. Mr. AA is a Syrian citizen and national who fled involuntary military service in a government-controlled militia called Jaish al-Shabaab, which I'll refer to, as the court did, as the government militia. He sought refuge in the United States and turned himself in to immigration officials immediately upon landing in the United States at JFK, and he applied for asylum. The immigration judge granted Mr. AA deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture, so he's not being deported anytime soon, if ever. But the IJ and then the BIA found him ineligible for asylum and withholding of removal, finding that his forced membership in the government militia qualified as material support of terrorism. This is because, as an arm of the Syrian government and Assad regime fighting in the civil war, the government militia has engaged in acts against Syrian civilians that meet the definition of, quote, terrorist activities, end quote, meaning that the government militia is an undesignated Tier 3 terrorist organization under immigration law. Mr. AA supported those actions because he was in the militia, albeit involuntarily, and he knew or should have known of the group's terrorist activities. Under immigration law, this bars him from asylum and withholding of removal. At the Third Circuit, Mr. AA argued only that the government militia cannot be a Tier 3 organization because it's a state actor, and that Congress didn't intend for the material support of terrorism bar to apply to nation states and their armies. In this case, all parties assumed that the government militia is a state actor because it's controlled by the Syrian government. That means it receives funding from the Assad regime and from Iran. The U.S. Department of Treasury has accordingly blocked the government militia's assets. But the Third Circuit agreed with the BIA that the material support of terrorism bar applies even when the Tier 3 terrorist organization, or any tier terrorist organization, is a state actor. It went through Mr. AA's statutory and treaty-based arguments one by one and rejected them all. So, Mr. AA gets to remain in the U.S. with cat protection, but cannot receive asylum, and does not have a path to a green card. He can be removed if and only if the situation changes materially in Syria. Here are some more observations on the terrorism bar. Listeners may be wondering why Mr. AA didn't argue that his involuntary and forced inclusion in the government militia didn't in and of itself excuse his actions. The reason is likely because the BIA largely foreclosed such an argument 2 years ago when, in matter of ACM, it held that the material support of terrorism bar lacks a duress exception. That was even the case with Miss ACM, a Salvadoran woman who was kidnapped and forced to cook food for militia members after watching her husband dig his own grave and then be murdered at the threat of death. The board held that nevertheless that constituted the material support of terrorism. According to the BIA, if a non-citizen seeks to waive or exempt his or her support of terrorism, even for reasons of terrible duress, the non-citizen can ask only DHS, and not an immigration judge, for such an exemption. Now, in this case, Mr. AA actually requested that DHS issue such an exemption through its sub-agency USCIS. According to this case, non-citizens can only apply for the exemption after an order of removal becomes final, meaning after the BIA issues its decision. USCIS denied an exemption in this case. Nevertheless, this decision goes through the obscure and not widely known factors and procedures for applying to USCIS for a terrorism exemption, so it's a decent resource. Finally, and to my knowledge, no circuit has yet expressly agreed that the legal definition of supporting terrorism includes support under duress. It does not appear that Mr. AA argued that matter of ACM was wrong, and that applying the terrorism bar, where support occurs under duress, does not meet the statutory definition, and leads to absurd results. This decision addressed the argument briefly and rejected it, though arguably in dicta. Maybe another attorney will raise the argument in a future case. And that is AA v. Attorney General of the U.S. Next up is Portillo Flores v. Barr, published by the Fourth Circuit on September 2, 2020. This is a split decision about asylum. Judge Thacker dissented. Mr. Portillo Flores came to the United States as a 15-year-old unaccompanied minor from El Salvador. He encountered CBP shortly thereafter and applied for asylum, claiming a fear of the International Criminal Organization, MS-13. In El Salvador, he had been approached, threatened, and beaten numerous times because a local MS-13 leader wanted to date his sister. They also threatened to kill his sister. Mr. Portillo Flores fled to a safe house in El Salvador, but he never left the house out of fear, and while in hiding, uniformed police officers came looking for him at his mother's house, and gang members kept watch of the house at a distance. He didn't report anything to the police because he believed that they worked with MS-13. He eventually fled to the U.S. and filed for asylum, based on his membership in the particular social group comprised of members of his sister's family. The IJ and the BIA denied the asylum application and claims for withholding and cat protection for a variety of reasons. The Fourth Circuit majority affirmed, but only for one reason. Mr. Portillo Flores did not show, as required to obtain asylum, that the Salvadoran government is either unable or unwilling to control MS-13. First had held, citing to prior case law in the Fourth Circuit, that someone like Mr. Portillo Flores, who doesn't report his fears to police, will, quote, generally, unquote, be unable to establish that the government was unable or unwilling to protect. Applying the substantial evidence standard, the Fourth Circuit found that the IJ and the BIA didn't commit error when the agency rejected Mr. Portillo Flores' testimony that reporting his fear of MS-13 would have been pointless, and indeed may have been dangerous. The Fourth Circuit also held, again, under the deferential substantial evidence standard of review, that the BIA wasn't wrong in finding that country condition evidence in El Salvador shows that the Salvadoran government has, quote, taken steps to reduce gang activity and police corruption, end quote. For similar reasons, the Fourth Circuit held that the record didn't show that the Salvadoran government would consent or acquiesce to the torture Mr. Portillo Flores feared from MS-13, as required to obtain cat protection. The majority opinion styles its decision as one resulting from the Circuit Court's deferential standard of review. Quote, like offensive linemen on a football team, standards of review are not glamorous or exciting, but that does not mean they are unimportant, end quote. But remember, practitioners, the substantial evidence standard does not apply at the BIA, and certainly doesn't apply at the IJ level. So, bad decision for asylum seekers, and the substantial evidence standard of review. Here's some more stuff. Some lemonade out of these lemons. At footnote 1, the court notes that Oil, quote, does not dispute that the IJ and BIA erred in finding an insufficient nexus between the alleged persecution and Mr. Portillo Flores' membership in a protected group, end quote, of members of his sister's family. So, practitioners, if you have similar particular social groups, as many of you do, here's a citation to show that Oil has not opposed the nexus or the PSG in the past, and as recently as this year. For what it's worth. Second, and to distinguish this case from yours, the outcome may have been different if Mr. Portillo Flores had submitted a bit more evidence of the complacency and of the interaction between the Salvadoran police and MS-13. An expert would have definitely assisted in that regard and may have made the difference. Finally, two words from dissenting Judge Thacker. Quote, the agency's decision here are precisely the kind of cursory opinions we have repeatedly rejected for their failure to engage with an applicant's arguments and evidence. This is not a case in which the agency adjudicators made the evaluation in the first instance that petitioner's failure to report was not justified. To the contrary, this is a case where the IJ and BIA both completely omitted the required analysis. End quote. So as Judge Thacker points out in the Fourth Circuit, if the IJ and the BIA completely omit the required legal analysis, the substantial evidence standard is irrelevant, and the decision must be remanded. Judge Thacker also addressed an issue that the majority avoided, and which at least the Second and Seventh Circuits have affirmed. The harm required to satisfy a past persecution showing is less when the victim is a child. So argue it, practitioners. And that is Portillo Flores v. Barr. Next is Ahmed v. Barr, published by the Eighth Circuit on September 4th, 2020. This case is about deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture and Bangladesh. Mr. Ahmed is from Bangladesh and came to the U.S. on a student visa. He was convicted of two aggravated felonies, and so, as is DHS's right under immigration law, DHS issued a final order of removal under INA Section 238 without putting Mr. Ahmed in proceedings before an IJ. But DHS didn't actually remove Mr. Ahmed, and instead made him report to DHS on a regular basis. Over the next 12 years, with the removal order hanging over his head, Mr. Ahmed got married and had two U.S. citizen children. But then, in 2018, DHS tried to execute the removal order and send Mr. Ahmed back to Bangladesh. DHS, however, found that Mr. Ahmed had a reasonable fear of persecution and torture based on his conversion from Islam to Christianity, thereby allowing Mr. Ahmed to pursue withholding of removal and protection under the Torture Convention before an immigration judge. Now, based on his decade-old crimes, the immigration judge found Mr. Ahmed ineligible for everything except CAT deferral, and then denied it. The BIA affirmed. Mr. Ahmed petitioned to the Eighth Circuit and simultaneously moved to reopen proceedings before the BIA to submit new evidence about his claim. The BIA denied that too. And here we are. The Eighth Circuit first held that under the Supreme Court's recent decision in Nasrallah v. Barr, it had jurisdiction to review Mr. Ahmed's claims, notwithstanding his criminal convictions. But reviewing the BIA's decision for substantial evidence, the Eighth Circuit denied the claims. Primarily, the Eighth Circuit found no error in the BIA's finding that the Bangladeshi government continues to take action against religious extremists who seek to kill converts from Islam. Though the Bangladeshi government hasn't always succeeded, its attempts undercut Mr. Ahmed's argument that the government in Bangladesh consents or acquiesces to such killings, as required to obtain CAT protection. This, even though Mr. Ahmed himself was once kidnapped and tortured by religious extremists. CAT protection can be difficult to obtain. The Eighth Circuit also affirmed the BIA's motion to reopen decision, specifically the BIA's finding that the new evidence submitted wouldn't likely alter the decision. Very unfortunate for Mr. Ahmed. Here's one quote to help in petitions for review. And indeed, it's an excellent quote for circuit court practitioners trying to craft their arguments of BIA error in a manner that will enable circuit court review of fact-finding. And it's similar to the one quoted by Judge Thacker in dissent in Portillo Flores just now. Quote, "An allegation of wholesale failure to consider evidence is a constitutional challenge that implicates due process." End quote. The Eighth Circuit rejected the argument here, but that standard is one to remember. And that is Ahmed v. Barr. Finally, we have Jaime Cardenas v. Barr, published by the Ninth Circuit on September 1st, 2020. This case is about Special Rule Cancellation of Removal under the Violence Against Women Act, or VAWA. Individuals who have been abused or suffered extreme cruelty committed by a U.S. citizen or LPR spouse are eligible for a variety of benefits under the VAWA. One such benefit is VAWA cancellation of removal under INA Section 240A(b)(2), a very non-citizen-friendly form of relief from removal that, if granted, provides the non-citizen with a green card. Also, and before we get started, and as many commentators have noted, the Violence Against Women Act is a bit of a misnomer, because men are equally eligible. Mr. Jaime Cardenas was placed in removal proceedings and found removable for being present without authorization. He then applied for VAWA cancellation, and, although an IJ and the BIA appear to have found that he did suffer abuse or extreme cruelty, he was found ineligible for VAWA cancellation because of a methamphetamine possession conviction. The Ninth Circuit agreed, rejecting Mr. Jaime Cardenas' arguments. The arguments were clever and complicated, based on an interplay between three immigration statutes. Here's what's up. One portion of the VAWA cancellation statute prevents non-citizens from obtaining relief if they've been convicted of certain crimes, such as drug possession or domestic violence. At the same time, INA Section 237A(7) waives a non-citizen's removability for stalking, protective order violations, or domestic violence convictions committed in self-defense, or quote, where there was a connection between the crime and the aliens having been battered or subjected to extreme cruelty, end quote. Returning to the VAWA statute, a third statute, a portion of the VAWA statute at section B5, allows for VAWA eligibility notwithstanding a conviction if that conviction satisfies INA section 237A(7), which I just stated, and which again waives culpability for stalking, protective order violation crimes, and domestic violence crimes committed where there's a connection to the battery or extreme cruelty. The problem for Mr. Jaimes Cardenas is that drug conviction crimes are not excused under Section 237A7. So Mr. Jaimes Cardenas argued that the VAWA section at Section B5 isn't limited by INA Section 237A7, but rather excuses lots of crimes, so long as there is a connection between the crime and the non-citizen having been battered or subjected to extreme cruelty. Mr. Jaimes Cardenas argued that he was only convicted of meth possession because of his wife's extreme cruelty, namely her bringing drugs into the household and being a drug addict herself, making Mr. Jaimes Cardenas eligible for VAWA cancellation, notwithstanding his conviction. The Ninth Circuit rejected this argument under the plain text of the statutes. According to the Ninth Circuit, the VAWA statute at Section B5, quote, incorporates only the authority provided at INA Section 237A7's waiver of deportability, end quote, which again is limited to convictions for stalking, protective order violations, or domestic violence where there is a connection between those crimes and self-defense or the abuse itself. This holding aligns with the Fifth Circuit decision from 2014. So, an interesting statutory argument rejected. Here's one observation. Although admittedly undercut by a footnote, this case, and likely the BIA's decision in this case, can be cited to for practitioners to argue that the facts of this case meet the abuse or extreme cruelty standard required for VAWA cancellation. Namely, a spouse is threatening or actually calling ICE on their non-citizen spouse, acting in a manner that makes the non-citizen spouse lose custody or control over their child, and actions that place the non-citizen spouse in a position where drugs or other criminal activity is present, arguably constitute abuse or extreme cruelty. And that is Jaimes Cardenas v. Barr. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate for 5 credit hours, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all. And follow the show on Instagram and Facebook, at Immigration Review, and send us a tweet, at ImReview, that's I-M-M Review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.